Thank you very much, Professor Kopp. Our next speaker is Professor John P. McCarthy.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to say I'm honored to be asked to speak to this gathering of the Philadelphia Society, and I'm quite overwhelmed by the size and the quality of this gathering, because my memories goes back to what one might call the catacomb days of the American right, back in the early 60s, when our gatherings might consist of small luncheons and occasional meetings in Chicago, facilitated particularly by the late Don Lipset, where a few of us graduate students would meet occasionally with F.A. Hayek, Richard Weaver, Milton Friedman, and bring as guest speakers to the University of Chicago people like Russell Kirk and Frank Meyer. Or further east, a few of us would gather, you might say, almost in the belly of the beast, in a center of light, an apartment in the west side of New York by the apartment of the late Murray Rothbard. And times were very lonely in those days. So it's quite encouraging seeing a gathering like this, and particularly to be asked to speak here. With regard to Ireland, if you want me to speak about Ireland, I'll take more than 15 minutes, or maybe well into the afternoon, so we'll pass that by, except for maybe an occasional reference in my talk. Decentralism and statism in the experience of Christendom. Let us begin by defining our terms. Decentralism and statism are self-explanatory. The former means confining political power to as local a base as possible. The latter means granting to political authority ascendancy over all aspects of human life. Now, decentralization works to inhibit statism, since even where a local regime might have totalitarian aspirations, its limited territory and size would inhibit its pretensions. Christendom refers to a specific territory, Europe, especially Western Europe, during a specific historical period, from the collapse of the Roman Empire to the Protestant Reformation, when there was a common religious creed despite ethnic, linguistic, and geographic differences. Then an individual's concept of membership was to Christendom more than to a nation or a state. Many good liberals, especially in the 19th century, characterized Christendom as a theocracy, the epitome of centralization and statism, especially because of the suggestion that the political authority emanated from the Pope. However, while there was that theocratic proclivity in Western Christendom, it was more the exception than the rule. In fact, the historical record of Christendom and the heritage of Christendom that continues, probably more in the United States than Europe itself, should indicate that Christendom was a major supporter of decentralization and opponent of statism. The very theological premises of Christianity militate against statism and favor decentralization. This is despite, and indeed because, Christianity is a universalist religion. Most pre-Christian religions were religions of a specific people or state. The Christian mandate was to convert the world. That could be seen, and no doubt was by some, as a directive for conquest and global uniformity. But, as the founder succinctly put it, his kingdom was not of this world. The Christians were not to construct a terrestrial utopia, but to preach a message with relevance to the next world. In addition, Christ said to leave to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but to God the things that are God's. That meant there were limits to Caesar's authority. Caesar and the state was neither the source of authority nor the determiner of right and wrong. Those two themes, that Christianity did not provide a specific political agenda as to how society should be organized, and that the state was not the repository of values, would be enduring characteristics of Christendom despite occasional lapses into that peculiar form of centralized statism, theocracy. The central message of Christianity, the incarnation, that is, God becoming man and bearing all the physical, psychological, and mental features of mankind, including a brutal death, meant that the Christian message was not entirely otherworldly, but was a realistic formula for the world as it was. Its disciples were not ethereal and/or passive beings acquiescing in predestined and circular determinism. God had entered the world, and grace was available to transform the world, not according to an ideology, but according to principle and a way of life. Christianity's early experience was one of martyrdom. Martyrdom occasioned by the refusal of Christians to worship the civic gods of the Roman Empire. The Roman authorities regarded their refusal to share the civic religion, more than their specific Christian beliefs, as subversive. All that changed when Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the empire, to the chagrin of conservative Romans who saw that as the beginning of the end. The 18th century historian Gibbons would reconstruct their lament in his argument that the Christian virtues of resignation and meekness, the message of the Beatitudes, were contradictory to what made the empire. But St. Augustine would confront those who saw Christianity as politically unconstructive with his monumental City of God, which reaffirmed the extraterrestrial vision of Christianity and freed it from linkage to any specific worldly political entity. However, when the empire did collapse in Western Europe, the church, which had drawn organizational and administrative competence from the empire, inevitably was called upon to fill the institutional void. The church's response in dealing with post-imperial Western Europe was to assert values other than those of the political authority, but not to impose a societal blueprint. British historian and cultural anthropologist Christopher Dawson has demonstrated how it sought to transform existing institutions, customs, and heritages with a Christian perspective, or allow actual grace to work its way in the existing raw material of human society. Warrior kings of the Celtic and Germanic tribes were gradually, very gradually, made to look upon themselves, at least in theory, as repositories of justice rather than being simply warlords. Their acceptance of consecration at their coronations imposed a sense of obligation, a sense of duty, as Burke put it, not shared by shameless democracies. Local pre-Christian shrines of naturalistic deities were baptized and made into holy wells and centers for popular devotion to Christian saints. The influence of Christianity guaranteed that the servile system of feudalism, with its element of contract, even if permanent and inheritable, would work toward ultimate liberty rather than regress into slavery. The ability to excommunicate kings and emperors was an important restraint on absolute political power. The courts of canon law, that is, those courts that enforce church law, whether it be about internal church organizational questions or doctrinal and moral matters, including marital and, inescapably, probate issues, played an important role in the Middle Ages. Admittedly, the concept of a church court having coercive power would appear outrageous in a pluralistic society, especially the concept of its jurisdiction being determined by the clerical status of the plaintiff or accused rather than just the matter at issue. This practice gave to clerics an immunity from other tribunals somewhat comparable to that claimed by contemporary academics and artists who accept public largesse but not supervision by the state. But the medieval courts of canon law must also be viewed in a more positive light. They had emerged from the written and proclaimed Roman law and were light years more advanced in procedural matters than the folk or even royal courts that had determined guilt or innocence by ordeal, battle, or by the social weight of referees for the plaintiff or accused. Furthermore, the canon law courts worked as a restraint on the growing claims by kings to have a monopoly on justice, especially the fruits of justice, that is, the fines that had to be paid. Thomas of Becket, slain on the orders of Henry II, was a martyr for the independence of the clerical courts from royal intrusion. 3.5 centuries later, Thomas More would be a martyr for the principle of the autonomy of the church in proclaiming its moral teaching against the aspirations of Henry VIII to overrule its decision on his marital status. Unfortunately, by the 13th century, the papacy made theoretical assertions that it was the source of determining the political legitimacy of kings and emperors. However, so vain an aspiration was an indication of hubris, as in the next century, the popes found themselves the virtual hostages of the French kings. There then followed the scandal of the Great Western Schism, which at one point saw 3 rival claimants to the papacy. Ever since, the papacy's coercive political power has been continually restricted, first being limited to the shrinking papal states, and today being confined to the few score of acres making up the Vatican. But the moral authority seems to have magnified in inverse proportion to the decline in political power, both within the was the replacement of the kings as the source of authority by the nation state with its earthly religion of nationalism. Significantly, the papacy opposed Louis XIV's expansionism and directed prayers of thanksgiving on hearing of the defeat of Louis' satellite, James II, at the Battle of the Boyne. The Irish Protestant victors, unfortunately, were unappreciative and imposed the penal laws on the Catholics of the island. A fragile alliance of the papacy and Whiggism of Burke's kind, began with the opposition to the French Revolution, which had abandoned all restraint on the assertion of authority by the political process. The French Revolution's logical successor, Napoleon, whom some Whigs sought to appease, was ultimately brought down by the forces of older Europe, including the church. Tension persisted throughout the 19th century between the church and liberalism because of the church's identification with the forces of reaction who sought to restore or preserve the pre-revolutionary order and who were inhospitable to the irrepressible industrial revolution and capitalism. At the time, few perceived that the medieval heritage of restraint on political authority, of decentralization and balance of power, was being best continued in 2 essentially Protestant areas of the world, Britain and the United States. Ironically, the political social institutions that today can boast of distinct roots with medieval times, that is, with Christendom, are the papacy, the Federal Union of the United States, and the British monarchy and Parliament. By the end of the 19th century, more thoughtful observers were beginning to perceive that revolutionary liberalism, carried to its full, would bring on the absolute state. For example, the utilitarians had argued that the free market best met the happiness of the greatest number of people. But their intellectual descendants, the Fabian socialists, argued that the masses had to be guided by the state to realize what was happiness. One of their apostles, Graham Wallace, called his formula of social organization the Great Society. In other words, liberalism no longer sought liberty, but instead a perfect society, the very thing the church, in its wisdom and understanding of human nature, knew could not be achieved in this world. The era in which the new liberalism, that is, statist liberalism, emerged, the latter part of the 19th century, has been best chronicled by that master historian, Carlton Hayes, in his classic work, A Generation of Materialism. Liberty, never mind religion, was subordinated to the pursuit of progress and development, guided by the infallible certainty of science. The forces that seemed destined for triumph were those characterized by modernity, industrialism, and political centralization, as was evidenced in the wars of the 1860s and 70s. Prussia and Sardinia had triumphed in the achievement of German and Italian political unification, and the victory of the North in the Civil War had forever foreclosed the option of withdrawal from the American Union. The door was open for state capitalism, with all the instruments of protectionism, imperialism, and expansionism in the name of modernization. This was the era, and those were the abuses which provoked Hilaire Belloc, with his English radical and French Jacobin roots, to begin to fear and forecast the servile state. He was joined in such by the democratic radical and Little Englander, G.K. Chesterton, who asked, "What's wrong with the world?" in succinctly describing the ascendancy of philosophical, socio-psychological determinism replacing a belief in liberty or values. That perceptive sociologist, Robert Nesbitt, acutely analyzed the phenomena that accompanied modernization: the disruption of traditional and local communities and the urbanization of Western society. As a consequence, there has appeared mass man, molded not by tradition and prescription, but by universal education and the mass circulation press, able to exercise the franchise and ready to follow such enthusiasms as nationalism, racism, and socialism. The 20th century had been the tale of the latter horrors being carried to the fullest extreme in the modern regimes of Stalin, Hitler, and Mao. The defeat of Nazism and the collapse of the Soviet Union should not blind us into the confidence that we are at the comfortable end of history. There continues the totalitarian potential in the Third World. The unification of the European community is scarcely the civilizational unity that Christendom implied, but rather an administrative and economic union in which authority appears increasingly distant from the populace, never mind not being seen as subordinate to any higher otherworldly source. Fortunately, the sentiment is strong in America, especially among those who consider themselves Christian, that the state is not the repository of human values. Enough of us still insist that the role of the state must remain limited to protection and justice, and not to the making of a perfect society designed by politically correct social engineers. Thank you.